From Boca Raton, Florida, this is Behind the Bima. On this episode, the rabbis are joined by world-renowned defense attorney Ben Brafman. Ben discusses what it's like being a visibly Orthodox Jew defending high-profile clients, how to humanize people accused of bad crimes, and his relationships within various segments of the Jewish world. Plus, the rabbis discuss the secrets behind a good sermon. And anti-Semitism is on the rise while a TV journalist offensively references the Holocaust. All this and more behind the Bima.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's Wednesday night. Welcome back. And I have to admit, I'm pretty excited about that. That was pretty cool. I am Rabbi Ephraim Gober, joined with my dear colleagues and friends, Rabbi Philip Moskowitz. And you may not recognize him after this haircut, but the one and only Rabbi Joshua Brody. Gentlemen, good evening and welcome back. Season 2, episode 9 already.
Wow.
Flowering our way through season 2 so quickly. It's great to be together yet again on a Wednesday night.
When does it happen?
I think we were turning over the seasons based on the Jewish calendar, right? Isn't that how we decided to do it?
That's okay. Crazy.
Amazing. Oh, I forgot my iPod. I want to thank our sponsors this evening, Michael and Aliza Austin and family, dear friends who moved to Boca fairly recently. They are sponsoring tonight in memory of their bubby, Zissel Bas Chaim, whose Shloshim is tomorrow night. Thank you so much for your generosity and sponsorship, and also for launching the start of Aliza Austin's new jewelry business, high-end affordable jewelry in South Florida. It's called Boca Treasures. Boca Treasures. You can find them on Instagram or call 732-995-9943. Call Aliza for high-end affordable jewelry, unless you are one of our wives. In that case, she is busy and unavailable. Don't bother trying to call. Just joking. Boca Treasures, everybody check it out. Thank you to the Austins, and it should be Le'ilei Nishmas Zissel Bas Chaim. We are together again for another Wednesday night. Gentlemen, what's new in your lives? What's going on?
Maybe we could start showing commercials now that we have this new technology.
Never know.
We'll be back right after these words.
Go big. Go big, absolutely.
Well, the weather changed here in Florida. That's exciting, right? Today may have been one of the nicest days I can remember in a long time, until the end when it got very windy. But for all those New Yorkers, people from the Northeast, I heard it was flurrying in Boston today. So it makes it all the more spectacular to have been taking a walk outside today.
It is great. The weather is magnificent and beautiful. Someone sent me a picture. They are still davening up north outside. They said it was 30 degrees. They were wearing tefillin that were like peeking out from under their down coat and scarf and hat. And I can't even imagine. But I do admire the Mesiras Nefesh. Tremendous commitment to davening with a minyan. If it means being outdoors, it's really something which is very special. And hats off to them. Only they shouldn't take their hat off. They'll be too cold.
I don't know if you guys saw this. Rabbi in Providence gave a lot of mussar to his community when they were complaining about going and standing outside in the 20-degree weather. He said, if you're willing to go to Foxborough Stadium, Gillette Stadium, and to sit outside for a football game in this weather, then you got to be willing to come to Minyan also. That's pretty hardcore. That's New England hardcore.
That is hardcore. A little guilt trip. Not sure it always works, but it is. And I'm not sure it could work on an ongoing or daily basis. People don't go to football games twice a day, morning and evening. But it's an interesting strategy, and I do admire it's a challenging situation that they are in. We have a great privilege this evening. We are welcoming a wonderful guest, a friend of Michael Austin, our sponsor for tonight, and a dear friend of Lester Henner. Thank you, Lester, for making the connection as well. But Mr. Ben Brafman, we're going to bring him on board just a moment. Mr. Brafman is one of the most recognized Orthodox Jews in America, accomplished in his field, world-renowned defense attorney who has defended many notable figures. Speaking of football, Plaxico Burress, Michael Jackson, Sean Combs, Puff Daddy, Mafia Boss, Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano, online gambling figure, Jay Cohn, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, Harvey Weinstein, and others, and has really defended people from all walks of life, which will be really interesting to hear more about. Very excited to be able to have him on. He proudly serves and has advanced his career as an Orthodox Jew, unashamed, unabashed of his Torah principles. And in that ways, in many ways, is a Kiddush Hashem. So it's really exciting to have him tonight.
Amazing. Real celebrity.
Yeah, you guys have really been chiming in. You're really fantastic tonight. You want me to drop off like a Mountain Dew or a Red Bull at your house? You need a cup of coffee or something? You all right?
No, I'm ready to go. I'll tell you the best part is Ben Brafman Davins and my in-law shul in the Five Towns. And you know, one of the most amazing things is that Minyan is the great equalizer. Right? When you show up to Minyan, Someone could be very prominent. It could be a lowly person. It doesn't really matter. When you're one of the 10 people of that minyan and you step those 3 feet into your Shmona Esrei, everyone is kind of equal before Hashem. And, you know, when I first started going to the Five Towns, I wasn't as familiar with who he was. And he's just a regular guy sitting in shul with his family, doing the same types of things that you and I are doing. And that was really my first introduction to him before I knew who he was. And in that regard, I always thought like davening is the great equalizer. When everyone's in shul together, doesn't matter where you are, what your parnasa is, before the eyes of Hashem, we are all equal.
That is true. Yep. That is true. Without any further ado, let's bring him in.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. And
so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for going behind the bima with us this evening. We're so excited to spend a few minutes with you. And first of all, I must tell you, you look fantastic. I hope that you're feeling well. We all know that, unfortunately, you had a fall this summer. And thank God you look strong and as sharp as ever. I hope you're feeling well.
I am, Baruch Hashem. I'm fully recovered. And I say Baruch Hashem 3 times a minute these days.
That's amazing. It is really great to have you with us. Before we brought you on board, we were talking a little bit about your background and about the prominent role that you play today in the legal system, and your reputation precedes you. You have represented people from all walks of life. Your name appears in a lyric in a song by Jay-Z, who apparently is not the same as Yoni Z, and might have an even broader following.
You know the lyric?
I don't know the lyric. How does it go?
Got coverage at Center Street. Got Brafman defending me because New York would miss me if I were in a penitentiary.
Wow. That is lovely. I hope that for all three of us rabbis, Mr. Brafman, we always get to know you in this capacity and God forbid never need to call you in any other. But we're grateful that you're with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start out your extraordinary family history. Your parents are Holocaust survivors. They fled through Cuba to come to America. And I'm curious what it means to you and what it meant to them to have a son who is educated and who not only took advantage of the opportunities that this great country provides, but has risen to such a position of notoriety and doesn't have to do so while hiding his Jewish identity or hiding his Torah or Orthodox identity, but that you have been sought after by prominent people, by celebrities, by people of all walks of life, not even despite your being a Jew or being Orthodox, in some cases maybe because of it. Is that some kind of vindication for your parents? Do you see this as some sort of a statement that a Jew today can play that role here in America?
Well, you know, my parents, unfortunately, are no longer alive, and they died more than 20 years ago, and I'm not certain either of them ever fully understood what it is that I do for a living, except that I was doing it well, to say the least. And, you know, I never thought of it that way as vindication for my parents. But, you know, the fact that they lost a lot and lived through a lot has always resonated with me. And, you know, there's a fear that is present when someone is in a courtroom as well. And that's whether or not they've been wrongfully accused or whether they have actually committed the crime. But it's inconceivable to me that you get picked out for that that distinction of being held to answer by the government. It's inconceivable if you were just a Jew. And that's why you were selected for that indignity of not prosecution, but persecution. I'll tell you something that I noticed. When I was representing Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who's formerly the former head of the International Monetary Fund, and, you know, literally who's who in France, if not the entire world, whenever there was an article in a French publication, they referred to me as the Jewish advocate. And I often thought, if I were just like a Protestant or a Catholic, would they say Dominic Strauss-Kahn's lawyer is a Protestant advocate? I don't think so. So there was something about the fact that I was Jewish, which made the French journalists sit up and take notice. So it was an interesting experience, to say the least.
That is interesting. And when you were growing up, when you were a child, did you offer great arguments? Did no one in your family ever want to get into debate? Could nobody beat you? What's it like to be the spouse or the child of Ben Brafman and have to come home and represent that you were right and the teacher was wrong, or why you should be able to get away with something? Did you know at a young age you had this power of persuasion, this ability to formulate an argument?
I
even today, how does it relate?
I was never able to persuade anyone in my immediate family that I was right and the Rebbe or the teacher was wrong. I mean, I just gave up after I was 8 years old. And I think all of that pent up frustration, you know, did well for me when I became a real advocate. But it's an interesting question. I remember arguing in class with a teacher or with the Rebbe, but, you know, never coming out ahead. Never.
So that skill set has emerged, bloomed more lately. I want to ask you what I think is probably on a lot of people's mind. I know it's on my mind. In many ways, in most ways, you're a walking Kiddush Hashem. As I said, when we welcomed you on, the fact that you are so prominent and proudly present yourself, your identity as an Orthodox, as a Torah Jew, is a Kiddush Hashem. And there are so many stories that reflect that Kiddush Hashem, whether it's the Puff Daddy story about Shabbos, which you can confirm with us whether it's true or not, a story that you've shared about when you were mourning an Avel and wanting to daven for the Amud and were being denied it because of certain garments you weren't wearing, and then that person needed to call you later. You're a Kiddush Hashem in terms of your values, how you carry yourself, who you are. And yet, on the other hand, as a defense attorney, you're in a position that you're defending people who are at least accused, allegedly have committed crimes, which are indefensible. Sometimes they are the poster children of the villains of what's wrong, Harvey Weinstein and others in that case. And do you ever have a concern that as a visibly Orthodox Jew defending people who are villains or the poster children for something so terribly wrong, that in fact it could lead to a Chilul Hashem?
Well, I don't think so. You know, I've always prided myself on doing my job well and trying to have a set of ethics as a criminal defense lawyer that I think are discernible and very important. And once you lose your credibility as a criminal defense lawyer, you're really worthless and not really worth as a lawyer. And I think once you compromise yourself, then people don't come to you and don't call you, and your career is basically over. You know, I'm Shomer Shabbos, I am Orthodox, but I don't flaunt it. I mean, when I'm asked, I tell them. And when Shabbos interferes with, professional duty, at least in the last 25 years, you know, I've gotten to the point now in my career when I walk into court and it's around Pesach time or around Sukkot time, I've had judges just stop when scheduling and say, just tell me, Mr. Braffman, what days can't you work? And, you know, when I first started out, my God, I couldn't explain Shmini Atzeres to a judge. I don't even understand what Shmini Atzeres is a celebration of. I could deal with Pesach, I could deal with Rosh Hashanah, but not the second day of Rosh Hashanah. I mean, I had some real interesting discussions with judges 40, 45 years ago, but I was a kid and I was, you know, a nobody in the criminal defense bar. And sometimes I had to, get into it with these judges, always respectfully. But at the end of the day, I think most of the judges today, they get it. They know that I'm observant and they don't try and fight with me over these things. Just not worth the fight.
And what about the general public? Do you have concerns about how you're perceived as being associated with, or I guess in your own consciousness and your own ethics? I mean, obviously, even the Torah endorses the notion of having a defense and a defense attorney, the presumption of innocence, and the halachic system is designed, in fact, to try to find every legal loophole to not have to, certainly in the case of a capital crime. But does your conscience ever kick in that you feel you're defending someone who you know is guilty, and how you could be associated with such behavior or with helping try to put them free on the street if, in fact, they're guilty?
You know, my job as a criminal defense lawyer, I don't pass moral judgment on the people I represent. I mean, if I did that on a regular basis, I would starve. Most of the people are not picked out of the yellow pages for the indignity of being prosecuted by the government. So I don't pass judgment. My job is to defend the case and to keep the government honest and to make certain that if you're going to convict someone on my watch, that you do so with legally obtained evidence, that you prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And in every case where I've gotten an acquittal, regardless of whether or not the person was or was not technically guilty, there's been a good reason for the acquittal. Either the accused is worthy of belief, or he is worthy of rahmanis or sympathy, or the people who make the accusation are much worse than he is. And in many cases, you know, I'm known as a good cross-examiner. Well, you know, sometimes it's a fair observation, and sometimes it's sort of like the person was eminently cross-examinable, as I like to say. And there are cases where if I was in a coma, I think I would still get an acquittal because they shouldn't have indicted this person. And in our country, you know, before you can really take someone's freedom away, you need to come to a jury with reliable, consistent, interesting, honest evidence. And when, you know, I'm in a case, the cases that go to trial, for one of several reasons, either the person accused is insisting that they are innocent, or the evidence against that person is just not worthy of belief. And in many, many cases, the government overcharges, they overreach. And that's when the case, it results in a sort of a dismal failure, because when they push the envelope, it normally falls off the table if you know how to deal with the system. And don't forget, as a criminal defense lawyer, I am fighting the government. And, you know, if you've ever been in a fair fight, that's not a fair fight. The government has incredible resources. They have the flag on their side. They have the power of standing up and saying, you know, the government calls the next witness. And I like to say, when I open in front of a jury, they can speak for the government, but they're not the government. You're part of the government. I'm part of the government. And my client, who is accused of a terrible crime, he's part of the government as well. So, you know, there's a leveling of the playing field that I think is very, very important. And if you win and you're the government and you win despite my best efforts, then, you know, the client deserves to be punished. Then it's a question of, you know, can I do damage control? And most of my work, you know, someone said to me, how do you spend most of your day? And I said, well, I started to buy suits with two pair of pants because I spend most of my time on my knees. and I'm begging. And I'm now, as I get older, I'm begging a prosecutor who's like 29. And they're always 29. And I'm getting older. And there's always this freshly scrubbed face of, you know, a kid who really doesn't understand anything about life. They understand the law and they understand that they have the power, but they really don't understand human nature. And sometimes they lose cases that they should win.
The other rabbis have questions. I want to let them in 1 second, but just one more follow-up. Is there a red line that you wouldn't cross? Is there someone who, if they performed a certain crime that you wouldn't defend? Would it be a racial crime? If someone were a member of the Klan, a mass murderer, an anti-Semite, a terrorist? Is there a red line where you've given that thought?
I think someone accused of committing a terrorist crime, they don't want me as their lawyer. Because, you know, with my parents, my grandparents, my maternal grandparents who were murdered at Auschwitz simply because they were Jews, I'm not certain you want me in the well of the courtroom defending you if you're accused of blowing up a building and killing 200 innocent people. Now, they deserve a defense because the people who are the most vilified really deserve a strong advocate, because there's nothing like vilification, you know, that can get someone, you know, convicted really easy. But they don't need me in the well of the courtroom. And I don't want that. I don't want to have to undertake that defense. And I really want to be able to understand the crime, understand the motive, and determine whether or not there is a defense. And to be honest with you, some of the most horrific crimes, or at least the crimes that appear to be horrific, they are sometimes made by people who have their own agenda. And when someone has their own agenda and they get a prosecutor to agree and drink the Kool-Aid, as I say, a scary proposition, scary kind of case. And that's when you need someone like me.
That Puff Daddy story is true?
Yeah. Which one? I've heard so many. But you're talking about calling me on Friday night?
Yeah, trying to get a hold of you on Shabbos. And it turns out
Friday,
he wanted to bet.
Friday night. Yeah, it was true. He called 1,000 times. And I called him afterwards. And I said, I told you not to call me Friday night unless it was an emergency. And I knew it wasn't an emergency because she didn't call the office and they didn't fax me a note saying he's just been arrested or he's just been shot. I don't know what the emergency could be, but that didn't happen. And yet my phone rang. So I'm sorry I didn't answer the phone. And he said, don't be sorry, man. He says, I won $10,000 because I bet my guys that you would not pick up the phone. So, you know, go figure, right?
That's great. I said a follow-up question to your earlier comment. In one of the interviews I read, you spoke about how everyone deserves to be humanized and that one of your jobs as a defense attorney is to humanize the defendant that you are obviously in charge of. My question is twofold. First, how do you do that? You know, some of the people you're defending have been accused of horrific crimes. How do you look past those accusations and humanize the person, both in your own eyes and in the public eyes? And I guess part two of the question is, how can we learn from that, right? We who oftentimes pass judgment on people, we who oftentimes read an article or see something in the news or assume something about someone else's positions and therefore automatically box them into a certain mindset, how can we look past that and humanize each other to maybe gain a different perspective on each other and maybe a little bit more of tolerance for each other also?
Well, someone asked me about that before, and I think my answer is always going to be the same. Giving people the benefit of the doubt is a very, very important principle among Jews and Orthodox Jews and people who learn Gemara and spend all their days in a Beis Medrash. I forgot the expressions of Damlikovskos. Someone should get the benefit of the doubt. I think one of the biggest problems I have when I come into a room filled with, people who are considered to be Orthodox is they live for Lashon Hara. And if you were in Beth Shalom, the shul I daven in, you would notice that the only person I ever sit with is, you know, one of my grandchildren or my son-in-law or my son from Eretz Yisrael who comes for a Shabbos. I don't sit next to anybody else because the minute I sit down, the first thing they do is say, well, let me ask you a question. Just hypothetically, the guy you're currently representing, you know, did he do it? And what did he do? And I look at them and I say, you know, if I were representing you, you would not want me to discuss that with anybody. And at my 70th birthday, my wife, who is a tzaddikus in her own right, and she made out wristbands for everybody who came to the party. It said, be like Ben, don't talk Lashon Hara. And I will tell you that every Yom Kippur, when I, go through the Al-Chaitz, I'm always stunned at how many of the Al-Chaitz deal with speaking parts, you know, Rechilas and Lashon Hara. And you're not supposed to make fun of people. You're not supposed to talk badly about them. And, you know, I think that that is a very, very sad reality. And I think among my fellow Jews, and I think it's a very big concern that I have, that, you know, people who are medaktik on every mitzvah and sit and learn all day, comes to Lashon Hara, they think they have a pass.
I will say, having davened in Beth Shalom many times, one of the most beautiful things is watching you interact with your grandchildren there every Shabbos up in the front corner. It's really nice to see.
Thank you. Next time you come in, you just say hello and I'll recognize you.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Who are you? Rabbi Brody. Why are you?
You know what? I was going to ask the Don Lakoff-Sluss question. I have it right here. And it's pretty
All right. Good. Great minds, you know. Now, great minds, man.
First of all, it's an honor. It's a really big honor to meet you. I've been following all your interviews. I've been reading all the articles and sat down with Lester today for about an hour. He tried to give the entire backstory. But one of the great things that you're so good at, you're so good at telling a story. You're so good at convincing people and writing that narrative. And how do you do that? As rabbis, we're always trying to tell stories. We're always trying to teach, and you do it in such a persuasive way. What's the secret?
Well, I think there are no shortcuts in my work, and I really have to live the life of the person I'm representing. And I have found that even people who have, you know, been accused of a horrific crime and are generally not nice people, they generally have a redeeming quality. And, you know, if you look hard enough, you're going to find a redeeming quality in everyone, I think, with some exception, but I think with everyone. And sometimes a case allows you to exploit that redeeming quality. And sometimes the abject terror that someone feels by being in what I call the loneliest seat in the world, when you're accused of a crime and the government is on the other side, and you've got, you know, me standing between them and the government and maybe a substantial period of time in jail. And ironically, you know, it's an interesting observation. I have tried cases now for more than 42, 43 years, and I've had hundreds of clients. And the interesting thing is, you know, there's a guy who's serving life in prison without parole. I represented him for 5 years, got acquittal after acquittal after acquittal. And then I said, you know, this is not going to work. You keep getting in trouble and more trouble. And on this case, I don't think I can do it. And he got convicted and he went to prison and he walked in the door. And do you know that he sends me a card for every Rosh Hashanah, every Pesach, every Hanukkah, for every Sukkot, for every Shavuos. I mean, this guy is an Italian guy, and he has all the holidays sort of, you know, mapped out for him, so he shouldn't miss one. And each one comes with a note, and he can barely write, but each one says, you know, Ben, I'll never forget how hard you fought for me, and I love you, and my best, you know, to your family. Now, I have, you know, Jewish client who was facing 25 years in jail when he came to see me. And through 2.5 years of begging and pleading, I ended up getting the guy six months. And that 25 years, and not 6 years, 6 months, which means he had to serve only a couple of weeks in jail. And then he went, and now all he does is complain. I mean, it's like a whiner. And he forgets how terrified he was when he came in. And, you know, then, you know, I didn't get him an acquittal or a not guilty or a probation or a letter of apology. I mean, this guy has now turned into like a terrorist in my life because I can never do anything right. And I said to him, you forget so quickly how frightened you were. No, I didn't forget. I forget. I don't forget. But you don't forget I was innocent, right? You don't remember that I was innocent. I said, okay, you forgot that and I forgot that you were innocent. Okay.
I want to ask you a little bit of a controversial question, which is the people that you defend, and you've even alluded to a few times tonight that they're not necessarily the greatest people, the best people, but they deserve a defense because the system needs a defense. If we allow innocent people to be found guilty, then the whole system breaks down. Therefore, even guilty people deserve to be defended, but you don't celebrate them. In the Jewish community, we've had some high profile criminals who were found guilty. And yet, you know, in one case, and again, I don't want to be controversial and I'm not going to tip my hat about how I feel, but in the Rabashkin case, for example, where clearly he was punished well beyond and went beyond the, from what I understand, the normal sentencing guidelines. And it was very unfair and unjust to him. And yet when he came out, a segment of the Jewish community has sort of celebrated him as a hero, even though while he didn't deserve the punishment he got, there were crimes, from what I understand, that were committed. How do you feel on that, on sometimes some of these individuals being celebrated, even if they deserve a defense, and even if they deserve a defense because the punishment is too harsh, should they kind of go quietly? Or how do you feel about when the Jewish community ends up celebrating such individuals?
Well, you know, I get asked a lot of questions like that, and it's an interesting question. It's a good question. And sometimes I say, you know what? It's sort of like trying to explain something to someone who has essentially, they drank the Kool-Aid. So, you know, like they've already poisoned their mind and there's nothing I can say to convince them. But I will tell you that nobody ever likes the work I do until they are in the room where they really need me. And then I'm the like smartest guy in America and everything I do for them is great. And I'm going to save them. And if I do save them, I'm invited to the chasana and to the bar mitzvah and to the, you know, when they're sitting shiva, I'm the first person who gets notified. It's really a remarkable transformation. But I want to say this without naming names. There are some people I've represented who've become extraordinary friends. And they've been very close and people who may have technically committed the crime that they were charged with. And some people even pled guilty and went to prison. But, you know, since then, we have become very, very close. And there are some people who are guilty of their crimes. And I'll talk about the Rabashkin case for a minute since you brought it up. It had nothing to do with representing him or helping him get his sentence commuted. But I read a lot about his case and I was intrigued by the thing that really struck me raw. And that is there was such anti-Semitism in the prosecution of this, you know, from guy from Iowa, surrounded by, you know, Guyam, who ran a plant that everybody, you know, was aware of, but the sentence that he got and the sentencing process was just so over the top that the only thing you could walk away from is that this was a very anti-Semitic prosecution. It was a very anti-Semitic sentencing. So I was pleased when he finally got out. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, Alan Dershowitz and the Aleph Society and Svi Boyarsky and the number of those. But I will also tell you that on a night when they had a fundraiser in Far Rockaway, where they were trying to raise money to help him with you know, pay for part of his defense. They had 500 or 600 people there. We had a fundraiser that night for someone who was dying, and we couldn't get 20 people to step up and write a check. So that sort of, you know, it didn't poison me because I've met him a couple of times now. And, you know, I think he thinks I was involved in getting them free, because every time I see him, he hugs me and he thanks me. And I went to a Chanas Sefer Torah for Alan Dershowitz at the Chabad Children's Museum on Eastern Parkway. And he was there, obviously. And, you know, we danced and, you know, I got pinned with the Mashiach pin. And I will tell you that I used to see the Rebbe every day. I lived next door to Lubavitch headquarters when I was a little boy. And from until the 15 years, I lived at 788 Eastern Parkway. And that is now the headquarters of the Lubavitch Meshulachim Society. I'll tell you a funny story. They invited me to speak at the annual Kinnas Shulachim about 3 or 4 years ago. I was the guest speaker. And I was very honored. And I got up and I said, okay, I'm going to tell you something I've always wanted to say to a group of 6,200 Lubavitcher Hasidim. You got to stop with the Zufaratzta. When I was a kid, they sang it every day, all night. I could hear it from my room at night. And I would scream out the window, enough! And the whole end of that song, you know, there are some songs you can sing it for an hour and then you get Zufaratzta. It was all night, all night. And I got the standing ovation when I asked.
That's great. First of all, thank you so much for giving us your time and being so generous. Yeah, we appreciate it. I just have one more quick question, and that is, you know, so much of your work is seeing some of the underbelly of society, some of the people who are not necessarily, as you say, we're giving them after Yona, and especially in the firm community. So often, you know, you'll open up a New York Post and you'll see a firm person on there and everyone will cringe a little bit because it's a reflection of our community and we don't like that to be the reflection of our community. You see it all and you're experienced to it all, and it's a reflection on you as a Jew as well. How do you look past that? How do you look past some of the challenges that you see within the Orthodox community? And instead of disengaging from the Orthodox community, you're very much engaged in it. And as you said, you don't force it on people, but you're not shy about it. Seeing the underbelly of the Orthodox community and some of the challenges that it has, how do you look past that and keep the hope and the optimism and focus on the better parts of it?
Well, you know, I tell you the truth, I don't see it as the underbelly. And I'll tell you, I was invited to speak at an Asifa put together by the Aguda, 10 years ago. And there were 3,000 Hasidim in the room, and I was one of the speakers. And I spoke, and it was, you know, good speech. And I got one question that night. I got a young man came up to me afterwards. He said, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yes." He says, "You're not going to charge me." I said, "No." He says, "I'm going to ask you a question." He said, "It's a good thing to have 2 Social Security cards in your name." And I said, "Yeah, it's a great thing. You should tell everybody in your family to get 2. And this way you could have your own minion, and, you know, when you get, you know, put in prison." But that's sort of a mindset of a very small group. And I will tell you the thing that bothers me. The thing that bothers me is that I think the media is basically anti-Semitic. And I think when a frum person lands on the cover of the paper, as you point out, or gets involved in a financial fraud in the Hasidic Shigai, and they got payas and the kapata, the average person who sees that paints with a broad brush. And I don't see it that way. I really see it as an individual who got in trouble, who happens to be a frum person. Because I will tell you what I found in the frum community. It says we are the best of the best community in the world in terms of religious groups. I mean, we feed more people. We stand in front of NYU Hospital on a Friday morning and you see bus after bus letting out hundreds and hundreds of women carrying packages, and they're delivering food for Shabbos. And every hospital in New York now has a Bikur Cholim room. You don't see that among other people. So I defend the Jewish community. And when someone makes a comment to me about how do you explain that the person is, you know, Orthodox and very devoutly Orthodox, and yet they committed this crime, you know, I stopped the conversation. I says, "Look, let me explain something to you. This guy may be a bad guy, but that doesn't represent the community. And the thing that's a bigger chilul Hashem these days is when you have the Haredi community and they don't want to wear masks. And, you know, then suddenly they have a, you know, an outbreak in their community and they got 500 or 600 people at a wedding. And, you know, I've got 100 nephews who live in Lakewood because my brother, Al Shalom, you know, had a big family, Baruch Hashem, and all his kids are in Lakewood. And they all say, well, we all had it, so we don't need to protect ourselves. And I said, that's a stupid argument for a smart guy because, you know, there's no method to the madness. Plus, I think you're making a chil Hashem if you choose not to wear a mask. And a couple of, you know, months ago, my brother's third year at site, and in August, I was invited to, you know, one of his talmidim, and I came into the house because they wanted me to say a few words. I was wearing a mask, and there were only one or two people in a room with 50 people. And they said, what would you say, you know, in Aaron's name tonight? I said, my brother were here. He would say, you guys should be wearing masks. And, you know, that's how my brother was. I mean, he was a, you know, a Hasidish guy, frum guy. He was a menahel his whole life. And, you know, he would, you know, he believed, Dina Malchusadina, that you have to abide by the rules. And in terms of, you know, when you're interfacing with the outside world, you have to be like edel and nice and polite and kind, in which he was. And now, I'm proud to say we have a cheder in Ramat Eshkol, and it's got his name on the wall. And, you know, it's probably the proudest thing I've ever done is build that cheder. And my son runs it. He's the manager.
It's a perfect segue because I want to pivot to that as we wind down. We've taken so much of your time already tonight. I have kids who live in Ramat Eshkol, my married daughter, and I've davened in your son's shul, so I'm very grateful to him for that opportunity. And his cheder, I think it's harder to get into his cheder than it is any Ivy League university in America. You got to know. In fact, the only reason we're having you on tonight is in case my grandson ultimately goes there.
Right?
Yeah, I need to know that I have an in there. So that's really the major reason.
I have an in, but I got to tell you, Rabbi, I get like 3 or 4 calls a day.
I'm sure.
Heavy duty people are saying, you know, Ben, I got Einiklich that live in Ramat Eshkol. And I say, you know, it's on a merit basis. But we are looking for a gymnasium. So if you can if you can build a gymnasium, you know, maybe we can do something.
Okay.
It's hard to raise money for a small cheder in Ramat Eshkol. It's a lot easier. Israel Cancer Research Fund, FIDF, you know. Those are easy. I've been the master of ceremonies at over 100 dinners from Jewish organizations. And to be honest with you, some of them are such easy sell. And when I try to, you know, speak to somebody about giving money to a cheder in Ramat Eshkol, the first question I get, well, do these kids go to the army? I said, they're 6 years old. I don't know what's going to happen in 18 years or 12 years. You'll ask them then, or you'll ask me then. But they're little kids. So.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you in winding down, because I'm really impressed by that. You know, the Lawrence world, the Beis Shalom world you live in is very different than your brother of blessed memory, who was a beloved Menahel, Yeshiva Rockaway, who had an extraordinary reputation and who was really beloved. And Yibadal Lachaim, your son, who's doing extraordinary things. And as I said, I've davened in his shul and I have nephews in his cheder. My sister-in-law's and brother-in-law's children, and they say amazing things about him. And that's a different hashkafah, it's a different world. And yet you've transcended those differences that many people get stuck in and that divide the community. And you've not fallen trapped to say, well, if they're in that hashkafah or in that direction or wear that type of yarmulke or wear that hat, then I can't support them or that I'm not going to get behind them. You speak with great pride of your son's cheder, of his shul. You spoke and speak with great pride about your brother and his influence. Can you speak to that for a moment? Why is that important? And how do you achieve that achdus? And how does one transcend the differences of within communities who are choosing certain differences have much more in common that divides them, but have significant differences? The Ramat Eshkol community doesn't overlap enormously with the Lawrence community that you live in, and yet you're able to live in both.
Well, it's sometimes not easy, but it's sort of what I do. You know, I don't pass moral judgment on people when I'm, you know, professional. And I don't, you know, it was only, I tell people there was only one line on the way to the gas chamber in Auschwitz, you know, and I don't care if you were half Jewish or kippah sruga or no kippah or into marriage, you were in line, you were going to the gas chamber, you were going to be murdered. So for us to fight amongst ourselves, to me, it's very sad. And when I see that, you know, I try to be a peacemaker. But, you know, I have a daughter and her son who you met because he was my tech support. you know, they're like me. And they are, you know, from, you know, Orthodox, Shoma Shabbos, the kids learn, but they are not like my son and his wife. But when they're together, they all get along very well. And I've often said, it's remarkable, you know, these cousins don't see each other for, you know, sometimes 6 months. And then when they see each other, it's like they never left. And, you know, one is, a from kid who, you know, doesn't have a TV in the house. And the other kid has every electronic device that, they make. And yet they manage to, get along and play nicely, and they don't argue. And I really think it's a tribute to the way my wife and I raised them. And I think it's an interesting dynamic. But I will tell you one last story, which left me very depressed for quite some time. There was an article in Mishpacha magazine. And when I was on the cover of Mishpacha magazine, my God, my children, you know, I would get kids coming up to me in the street, asking me to autograph the magazine. And I didn't realize what a following that magazine had. And then there was an article about kosher food in prison. You know, and I tried to explain to them, don't do this, because people are going to think, well, there's so much Jewish prisoners who deal with kosher food. And the fact is that Otisville, which is, you know, everyone knows about, it's a prison that has 100 beds. And, you know, we told the Bureau of Prisons 25 years ago, don't do this. Don't put an Orthodox Jew in Wisconsin and another one in Minnesota. If they live on the East Coast, put them here. If they live on the West Coast, put them in another place. And you'll have no lawsuits, because these people are entitled to, you know, kosher food. And, you know, we got it because they were giving the Muslims pork, free diets. They couldn't eat pork. So when they decided, so we decided, you know what? That's it. We should get kosher food. So they're doing an article, and they have like a little sidebar. And the sidebar was about a very frum man who was so medakdek on kashrut that he didn't like the hashkacha for the meat that they had in Otisville. And there was a separate, you know, kind of hashkacha that only he knew about, and he wanted, and he, you know, wanted the Bureau of Prisons to get it. So I was interviewed by the reporter, and she said to me, what do you say to the guy who demands this level of kashrut? And my instant response, which she wrote down and printed, was, you know, if that's how strongly he felt about these mitzvahs, maybe he should have thought twice before he did what got him sent to Otisville, because I think that's a pretty big avera, and yet this is the thing he's worried about. You know that I got death threats after that was published? I got anonymous writings, who the hell do you think you are? You know, and in Yiddish, they didn't know I read Yiddish. And in Yiddish, you know, terrible things that they were saying about, you know, me, because I happened to comment on something which to me was an obvious response. And now I realize, you know what, you got to be careful what you say, who you say it to, and where it's going to get printed. Because for everything you say, which sounds like it's a good idea to you, it's not a good idea to everyone. You know, so don't look for trouble.
Let me ask you the last question of the night. You've been
that about generous. 5 or 6 times. Or
that's the that's the rabbinic move.
Trick.
It's the same move we pull when we say, you know, in closing or right. My last thought. Right. You know, right. You have your moves in the courtroom. We have right. We have our moves right. On the pulpit. Right. Well, the last question. Okay. Give us the tools for a winning argument. If we're trying to persuade someone of something, we're trying to win an argument at home with our neighbors as a rabbi, what are the most important tools? What are the tricks of the trade? How do you formulate your argument to be that winning argument?
Well, I will tell you that most cases are fact specific. So I have found that there really aren't a lot of good arguments that work across the board in every single case. But I will tell you that in most of my cases, one of the witnesses is generally much worse than the person I'm representing. And generally speaking, they're people whose credibility gets eviscerated. And I once, you know, looked at a group of people, and it just came, you know, to me as I was talking to them. And I said, you've heard the testimony from, you know, X, and you heard his testimony on direct and cross. So let me ask you a question. If you were leaving on vacation for just a couple of days, would you give him the keys to your house and say, go ahead and water my plants? There isn't. You're not going to do that. So you want to give the government the keys to my client's life. And, you know, in my business, rabbis, you really have to focus on, you know, you asked me about humanizing a client. You really have to make, I think jurors afraid. And I'll tell you one thing that I found worked, and certainly in the Puff Daddy case. You know, he took the witness stand and he testified in that case, which is quite unusual. I've had, you know, 150 trials. I've had three people who've testified on their own behalf, because one, I wouldn't let somebody get up on the stand and testify to something which wasn't true. And in every case, you know, there is either a state of mind defense or an element defense, where there is one element of the crime has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But, you know, Puff Daddy testified, and, you know, I wanted him to testify because, A, he didn't have a gun. And I knew he didn't have a gun, and I knew who did have guns, and it wasn't him. And second, he told the following story in the first five questions. What is your name? Sean Combs. What do they call you? Puffy. Where, what is your business? Well, I'm in the record business. I said, well, when did you start? When I was in college. You know, how did you start? I was an intern for Def Jam Records. And what happened? Well, I was an intern for 3 months, and then they made me president of the company, and I had 600 people working for me. And I just wanted the jury to hear that. And I remember standing up there and said, did you hear what he said about how he took over that company and had 600 people working for him when he was 19 years old? Says, do you have 600 people working for you ever? So if you believe that he is the ability to become the most successful African-American entrepreneur in the history of America, you got to be right. You got to know that your verdict is accurate, it's consistent, it's reliable, it's something you can feel comfortable going to sleep on. And I think that argument, you know, between us is something that resonates in almost any argument. And obviously the stakes in my part of the world are generally higher, but I think you need to grab a jury's attention. And, you know, Rabbi Goldberg, all I've heard is wonderful things about you, that you're a smart guy, that you're a great speaker, and you probably be a great trial lawyer. But, you know, I think I could be a good rabbi if I learned a little bit more than I do, than I know now. So if you ever want to invite me down to be a scholar in residence, I'll keep it a secret that I'm really not a scholar, but I'll make believe. So
consider it done. We want to thank you for tonight, Mr. Ben Brofman. Okay. Thank you for giving us your time, your wisdom, your experience, your stories. Continue to make a Kiddush Hashem. Thank you for your time. And we can't wait for Corona to be over. You'll come down, and we can't wait to have you. And like most New Yorkers, buy a place down here and spend more time. It was seven.
Well, I already have a room in Weston's new house. So, you know, to the extent that you have met him and he's made an impression, I'm going to be his first guest once the planes actually stopped in New York and in Florida.
We can't wait to have you. Thank you so much, and continue to feel well. God bless you. Thank you.
Wow.
All right.
First of all, his son-in-law that he referenced, greatest gabbai. Great gabbai.
Yeah.
Just point that out there. Yeah.
So important to have a great gabbai. That was really fascinating. A little behind the scenes thinking to how one of the most accomplished defense attorneys does his work. As I said earlier, we hope to never, ever need to call upon him professionally. But what's not as well known is I know people who've called him for his wisdom, didn't hire him as an attorney, don't have the deep pockets to be able to pay, and yet he's very generous with his time and his wisdom to people who need it also, which deserves to be mentioned as well. So we're grateful to Mr. Brofman for being on. And like I said, I think it's unusual to be able to have that clarity, to realize what's important, what's not important, to be able to support and be proud of family who maybe aren't living exactly the same, and to operate in different worlds. And he's clearly an open-minded and tolerant person to be able to defend and spend time with some of the people he is. So it's really something extraordinary. That was great.
What would you have answered to your question? Keys to persuasion as a rabbi. You're in a conversation with someone trying to persuade them about something about Judaism, to take on something new in Judaism. What are your keys to persuasion?
I think actually, first of all, you can't compare it to a criminal defense attorney and as a rabbi trying to persuade. Although we're in the business of trying to persuade, we're trying to sell Torah and persuade people to be inspired to grow and to change their lives. I think one of the most important, very counterintuitively, one of the most important skills to persuading is to be a good listener. When you listen, you know what makes a person tick. You know what inspires, what motivates, you know what their concerns are, you know what the obstacle is to whatever it is that you're trying to persuade them to do. So if you come in guns blazing and you're more concerned with being right than effective, you won't get anywhere. But if you want to be effective, if you want to walk out with the result you're looking for, not just unload your opinion and be right, then you got to be a good listener. You have to be willing to listen. There's an amazing book, one of Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath. He tells the story of one of the great attorneys today. I forgot his name, who was dyslexic, is dyslexic, and describes that in law school, when everybody else was scribbling notes, when everybody else was reading like crazy, he had to listen to the professor because he was dyslexic, couldn't read as well. And in order to succeed in law school, had to hone that skill of listening. And he attributes that honed skill of listening with his success as a trial attorney, that when a witness is on the stand, he hears things that others wouldn't. So when you listen and you listen well, it gives you the access and the window into what you could say to try to persuade someone. I think that may be true in the, I don't know, the law business, but I think it's true in our business. If you have to understand where a person's coming from, if you just try to offer them the Bible codes or tell them that chalent is delicious, they have to keep Shabbos, or you try to inspire them in whatever way to be the best husband or wife or mother or father, it's not going to work if you don't know how to listen and know where they're coming from. What do you think?
First of all, that's what we always speak about, that first seek to understand and before seeking to be understood. But I think one of the great things that I've seen both of you do actually in your drushas and your classes is you make the examples very crystal clear and practical for people. So if you're giving a drusha about a topic or you're speaking about a topic, you're giving a class about a topic, you don't just speak about it in some amorphous terms. But by the end of the sermon, every single person in that room, you have given an example that speaks directly to them. And they feel, wow, Rabbi Goldberg or Rabbi Brody nailed it on exactly where I'm struggling, what I need to improve on, what change I can make in my life. I think when it comes to persuading someone to do something, the more relevant you can be for them and the more examples you can give that speak directly to them, the more they feel like it's not just you're speaking to them. And I think that makes a big difference.
You know what? One of the things I've noticed over the years, you know, when you, and you can probably see this with some of our friends who like to give, let's say, a Dvar Torah at the Shabbos table, or, you know, different rabbis perhaps that like to give a nice, you know, theoretical message, let's just say. And I think over the years, I feel like as I'm getting older, I listen to some of them and I say, you know, that's great in theory, but it's not real. It just doesn't work. Like, the world doesn't work like that. I can't even relate to the message you're trying to give. I understand this is who says it, and that's who says it, and that, but it's not, you can't touch, you can't feel it. I'm not convinced because I don't bring it down, bring it way down.
You know, it's funny you say that, Rabbi Moskowitz, Rabbi Brody, and I appreciate that compliment, and I think it's true about you also. It frustrates me. I happen to be one of those rare people who love to listen to people speak. I'm unusual. I posted a question on Twitter and Facebook that our friend Ed Reichenberg started that conversation. But once the vaccine is advancing and we're going to return to a normal shul life again, what do you hope doesn't come back? And fascinating, countless, dozens and dozens of answers, from Anam Zmiros to the Kiddush Club to Misha Beirachs to all kinds of things. But there were a few people who were not hesitant to answer a rabbi's question by saying, I hope the rabbi's sermon doesn't come back. Who needs those long drushes? It's possible that our gabbai of the Hashkama minion texted me today, who followed that conversation and said, basically, you see, the whole world wants essentially Hashkama minion all the time at all hours. So it is interesting. So I'm one of those rare people who does enjoy a good speech. I not only a good speech, I believe you can learn something from every speech. From some speeches, you learn, if it's a good speech, what they did right. And from the speeches that were totally, you were turned off, you can listen and learn what they did wrong. But there's something as a rabbi and public speaker to learn from every speech. So I can't tell you how often I'm frustrated, and you'll appreciate this, Rabbi Moskowitz in particular. I listen to a rabbi and they give a great drasha. This commentary said that, and this one said that, and this one said this, and then they stop. And I say, what happened? You didn't bring it home. You didn't give illustrations, examples. You didn't make it real. You didn't make it resonate. You didn't paint a picture for everyone sitting there where they see in their own life why that message is important. They didn't see a picture of them being the better version of themselves. You stopped too soon. And I want to just get up and jump on the bima and say that was amazing. Let me just finish it for them. They forgot the punchline. It would be like Mr. Ben Brafman giving an amazing, amazing, and forgetting the closing argument. You were right up to the punchline and you didn't give the closing argument. You didn't close. So I think that's the key. The key to the great sermon is the illustration. Paint a picture. Let the person see themselves in it. Let them see it. Let it jump off the page. V'chol ha'am ro'im es ha'kolos at Har Sinai. We saw the sounds. That's our job as rabbis. To make the members, to make those who are sitting there see the sounds. We're speaking, but they need to see an illustration, a picture of the sounds that we're saying, and they can picture themselves in it. I think that's our job.
Love it.
How many times have you and I sat there? How many times have you and I sat there where I've shown you a drasha and you're like, Rabbi, you're like at the 1 yard line. you got to add on that 1% and you'll be there. But that's one of the great things I think you and my other rabbinic mentor, Rabbi Penner, have both taught me, is that it's all about the message and it's all about bringing it home.
Appreciate that. It's the difference of good to great. But hold on just one moment. Shame on you segment. It's very sad that each and every week we find something to point our finger and say shame on you. The FBI this week came out with their statistics about hate crimes, and tragically, sadly, and very disturbingly, in particular, hate crimes against Jews have gone up in 2019 by 14%. That's very disturbing. The FBI report from 2019, hate crimes against Jews, which, by the way, are the single biggest hate crime against any religion, is against Jews, and they went up by 14%. So anti-Semitism is still something that we need to confront and take on, and almost every week we find something. Now, last week we pointed out one of the stars of the Food Network who tweeted something grossly inappropriate, and in our Shame on You segment, I'm tempted to play that again, but I won't. In our Shame on You segment, I forgot his name already. Alton Brown. I used the term that it was anti-Semitic, and my mother took me to task afterwards, very gently, very kindly, but she said, you know, we have to be very careful how we use the expression of the term anti-Semitic. What he did was inappropriate. What he did was offensive. What he did was insensitive. But that's not the same as crossing the line of anti-Semitism. And if we cry anti-Semitism when it's not, then people won't listen to us when it is. So I thought my mother, as usual, had a very, very good point. And I think we have to be careful of when we apply the term anti-Semite. But for our Shame on You segment tonight, we want to highlight CNN's Christian Amanpour, who, in the anniversary of Kristallnacht, equated President Donald Trump's tenure to Kristallnacht and to the suffering of the Jews under the hands of the Nazis in Germany, was what it's like to live under Trump here in America. After there was an outpour against her, she said, and I quote, "I should not have juxtaposed the two thoughts," she said. "Hitler and his evil stand alone, of course, in history." Would you consider that an apology? I should not have juxtaposed the two thoughts. Because in our Shame on You segment each week, not only do we find people who shame on them, but usually right after the shame on them, they come out with some form of an apology. And we've talked a lot about what makes a good apology. All right. What are the ingredients of a real apology?
Yeah, well, the words "I'm sorry" usually play a significant role in any apology. But the common denominator between Christian Amanpour and Alton Brown is that they're going to get away with it. That if this happened in other communities with other types of comments, there's no way the communities would have backed down. It wouldn't have changed news cycles as quickly as Alton Brown's did. And the sad, tragic part of all of this is that Alton Brown got away with it. He made a comment that was egregious, that was completely inappropriate. So did Christian Amanpour. And we let them get away with these pathetic excuses for apologies.
We are the only ones talking about it. There is no one else.
So what I would say to, in consistent with my mother's insight, is that we can stop short of saying it's anti-Semitic and still say that, just like the cancel culture has canceled countless others for less egregious things, and just like the cancel culture has created a level of sensitivity and put a very high bar when it comes to racism, homophobia, Islamophobia, all kinds of other issues, how come when it comes to offending the Jew, there's no cancel culture? Food Network continues. Christian Amanpour, who, by the way, has a history of this kind of thing. This is not new, nor did she issue what is a reasonable or even any form of an apology. Where's the cancel culture?
One of the interviews I was listening to with Ben Bronfman before the show was talking about how intent plays such a big role in what the crime is and what was committed. And I'm wondering what he would say. Would he say, listen, they were just stupid. They said something that they weren't thinking, you know, and therefore we should be less judgmental, that we should be easier on them? I don't know. I'm just wondering.
No, but it's not about them. That's the problem. It's not about Christian Amanpour. It's not about Alton Brown. It's about the people that read that and assume that it becomes acceptable in American culture to make those types of comments and those types of references. You can't compare, again, love Trump or hate Trump, you cannot compare what happened in Nazi Germany to the administration here in America. And to do so is an abomination. It's desecrating the memories of millions of our ancestors, and for Jews around the country, left, right, center, to not be up in arms about it is crazy. And I personally think it is a it is a fault of our own community, because the difference, Rabbi Goldberg, in your answer is that other communities would have been so up in arms that these institutions would not have had a choice other than to cancel. And the right. Jewish community accepts the apology and allows the news cycle to turn over.
Well, that's about to change. First of all, I think your Wi-Fi provider might be anti-Semitic because you're coming in and out a little bit. But aside from that, I will say this. That's going to change. An anonymous donor called me, anonymous to you, not to me, called me last night and follows our show. And we've talked about this website we want to create in which when someone crosses that line, we have an address to go to that has essentially a scorecard. The people who are pro-Israel and pro-Jewish, we give the email, the phone number, how you can show support, and how you can applaud them. And the people who cross that line, we got an email, a phone number for how you can protest, how you can object, and how you can make it go viral, what they've done. And I think it's missing. I haven't found it right now. A very simple landing page of a website, very straightforward, not a lot of tabs, not a lot of credits, not a lot of buttons, very, very simple and straightforward based on what's going on in the news. Who's the person who boycotted Israel? Who's the person who performed in Israel despite the calls for boycotts? Who's the person who crossed the line and said something insensitive, borderline anti-Semitic? Who's the person who stood up and said, I'm not going to tolerate that? Because you're right, if we're not going to stand up for ourselves, then no one else will. And whatever the ethics of a cancel culture are, look, Rabbi Brody, to respond to what you said, I believe in apologies as much as anybody. I'm not perfect. Can any of us say, even the great Mr. Ben Brafman, I'm sure would say, that there are things that we've said that we regret, we could have said differently, should have said differently, every one of us. But the key is, and you know, our former guest, Ben Shapiro, a member of our community, and Shul, Ben Shapiro has a tab on his website where he lists all the things that he regrets saying the way he said it, or things he wishes he never said. And I think that that's a very Jewish idea, is you can get up, Christian Amanpour or the Food Network guy whose name I have a mental block to, if you get in face the camera and say, look, I had a brain freeze. I said something moronic. It was insensitive. I can't sleep. I have incredible remorse and regret. I feel beyond terrible. Here are the steps I've taken. Here's how I'm working on it. Here's how I want to correct it. Here's my promise and pledge to you not to do it again. With open arms. Absolutely. Who doesn't deserve a second chance? But it's these half-baked fake apologies, which are enough for the world that's afraid to cancel them, just enough for them to be able to say, let's move on. That's what we shouldn't tolerate.
Love it.
Rabbi Moskowitz, Morty Lent says, thank you for your kind words about him. We could always use new, we have fantastic Gabayim, but you can never have enough good Gabayim. So Morty, when your father-in-law comes down to Boca, come join him. We always have room for another Gabay. Gentlemen, it's been another amazing episode. I want to thank you. We don't yet have our, hold on one sec. Justin, as we close
breaking news. First of all, you feel like you're at APAC policy conference when you hear that, right? That's how they introduce like the segments.
We're working on these things. It's just the beginning. We're just getting started. But this breaking news as we close tonight with, again, a special thank you to Michael and Aliza Austin and family for sponsoring in memory of their Bubby Zisel Bas Chaim, whose Shloshim is tomorrow night. And the launch of Aliza Austin's business should be with Mazel Baracha and Hatzlacha. Boca Treasures, high-end affordable jewelry in South Florida, available to anyone except for the Birdies, Goldbergs, and Moskowitzes. 732-995-9943. Get a hold of Aliza. This breaking news as we close, Carmela's, the second new restaurant in Boca, the dairy restaurant, opens tomorrow night. They did not sponsor tonight, so we're not giving out a phone number. When they sponsor another episode, we'll get out the phone number. But it is breaking news for those.
We get the sponsorship when we have food on the episode. That's about the number.
Either one. But our good friends, the owners of that new group of restaurants, we love all the restaurants, and anyone who invites us in, we'd be happy to stream from there. But Carmela's opens this week. That is breaking news, and we're very excited. Again, with tremendous gratitude to Mr. Ben Brafman for joining us, giving us his time tonight. Thank you, Rabbi Moskowitz and Rabbi Brody. Until next time, everyone, stay healthy, stay happy, and stay holy.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Bima. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week for another peek behind the Bima.